on ABC Radio.
This is The Big Fish
with Scott Levi.
Good morning. Welcome aboard another edition of The Big Fish. First cast this morning, we get a first-hand account of the damage being done by Opera House yabby traps in the streams and rivers of the Great Divide in New South Wales. And we're heading off to the International Boat Show at Darling Harbour in Sydney for a tour with Tim Stackpool.
Come on down to my boat, baby. Come on down where we can play. Come on down to my boat, baby.
All coming up on The Big Fish. Keen ACT fisher Daniel Campbell made a gruesome discovery on his local pristine stream the other day, just something that really sickens the heart of every caring angler. Good morning, Daniel.
Morning.
You're up around Captain's Flat, I believe, scoping out a few spots for the upcoming season and came across something terrible, is that right?
That is true.
Tell us about what you pulled out of the river.
Oh, my partner and I were just getting out for a few little fishing spots, and we stumbled across a Opera House net that looked like it had been sitting in the water for about 3 weeks or 4 weeks. Now, being made aware to the damage that they have been causing throughout Australia and its native wildlife, as of the Victorian complete ban, we decided to take the initiative to remove it from the waterways, given that it was trout waters and no nets are actually allowed. Now, upon that, we discovered that there was 4 dead platypus in it. We've removed it to the banks and cut the net open. We documented the area and took some screenshots, some photos of our find, and immediately reported it to fisheries.
Not one, but 4?
Yes, 4. Lucky enough to even find one these days.
That's just devastating, isn't it? That's heartbreaking. Daniel, what would have been a lovely trip into the bush turned into a nightmare, really?
Yeah, it was pretty big spoil to the day, but given circumstances, take the initiative to try and get the word out there as much as possible.
Dr. Tom Grant is a platypus researcher.
But I've been researching up there, upstream from that spot where Daniel found them for the last 40-odd years. So it really shocked me when I heard about it.
Yeah, you probably knew some of these platypus or knew their,
well,
you know, their parents.
We've got several hundred microchipped in that stream, and maybe they still have microchips in them. But it's a fair way down from where we normally catch them. It's about 10 river kilometres down from my study area. But they do move up to these distances, so it's a possibility that there may even have been some of my microchipped animals.
Just one of the great thrills for a fly fisher to be sneaking along the stream and to catch a glimpse of one. You see them quite regularly, actually, because they feed at dawn and dusk, and you're out there waiting for the evening rise, and you're quiet. And the number of them that I've cast a fly to, Daniel, thinking it was a big rising brown trout, it's been phenomenal. But, you know, you can't hurt them with fly fishing gear. They won't take a fly. But it's such a shame. Tom, what are you calling for, and what are the conservationists calling for in relation to these Opera House traps, and why are they so deadly?
Yeah. Well, the thing is that once platypus goes in, and we've actually, with the Australian Platypus Conservancy, we've done some research looking at how we could keep them out of yabby traps. And the 9-centimetre ring, which keeps a lot of big turtles out, but certainly doesn't keep out water rats or birds or water birds or platypus. We found that, you know, you have to have a much, much smaller ring in these things to stop them getting out. But we've also done some work that shows you can catch platypus, you catch yabbies at least, and let platypus come out of an open top trap, which is what they've done in Victoria. They've made the Opera House trap, the closed trap, illegal to use in any waters, including private and public waters. And as a result of that, I mean, the market's dropped out of it, and also under public pressure, the major retailers in Victoria have just stopped selling them. And the ones that Daniel picked up is one that's being used illegally anyway, because they're not allowed to be used east of the Newell Highway in New South Wales, which gets them out of, theoretically, out of platypus waters, because the platypus doesn't go any further west than that.
In the big department stores and the fishing shops, they're selling these things. You'll see the local council putting up signage all around the local rivers saying, don't use Opera House traps in these waters, and yet there's no education at the point of sale, at the fishing shops or in the department stores where they sell these things to people.
And I mean, Fisheries put out a, when the regulations came in 2003, they put out an A4 poster that was meant to go out to all fishing shops, so they put them up where the traps are, but you very seldom see them. And so people aren't aware. These people that were using this trap may well themselves have been shocked if they went back and found that they'd drowned a couple of platypus, four platypus, which is even more staggering.
And why would they go in? Is it to get the bait or is it to get the yabbies?
Good question. We don't really know. We assume it's to get the yabby, but we've actually found that some that have had platypus in the trap, and no remains of a yabby seems to be there. So maybe they're just inquisitive. They also stick their nose into these rings that women put around their hair. They've stick their nose into them and get them tangled around their shoulders and things that cuts into the flesh. And so they're really, I think it's inquisitive. They just find a hole and they sort of have a look at it and stick their nose into it, because they're moving their bill around to find their food. And they could pick these things up. Maybe they just bump into the trap and they go in, and then, of course, they can't get out.
You mentioned the Australian native water rat. I if listeners of the Big Fish have been listening, you know, I'm driving a campaign to call them the Australian native otter. They're just so beautiful.
They're such a
great little creature.
Yeah.
And they're not at all ratty, in my opinion. They get a bad rap being a rat. But
they certainly do, yeah.
Will they be trapped as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we always assume that that they could, because they chew, they're good at chewing things and biting when you have to handle them. But we assumed they could chew the way out. But we're now finding more and more, and that goes over into South Australia as well, where there's no platypus, but there's water rats, and they're still using Opera House traps there as well. But we find these dead water rats in there, and we assume that once they go in, they realise that they should get to the surface to breathe. It's too late by then, and they probably don't have time to chew their way out. So they're actually turning up very often. The Australian Platypus Conservancy have got a big list of places where water rats have been. And as you say, they've got a bad rap because they're rats. They're now referred to in Victoria as Rakali, which is the Aboriginal word for them.
I like that. I like that.
And they, as you say, who would look at an otter when you can watch a water rat sort of running around, clambering up the bank, diving back into the water, chasing each other? Fantastic, yeah.
I love the little piles of shells they put up too.
That's right.
You know, they make little monuments. They make cans. But, you know, they're fascinating. And look at their face, and they don't look at all like a rat.
No, they don't, yeah. And that big tail with the white tip on the end is beautiful, yeah. People like yourself who are quietly fishing on the river see a lot more than we do, because we're normally sort of catching them, putting microchips in, taking blood samples, all that sort of stuff. And very few of us actually sit and spend the time watching them, because we're too busy doing other things. Live fishers and bass fishers are the ones that come up with the observations of platypus, because they're moving quietly and the animal doesn't worry about them until they make a sudden movement. Because normally you can, if you move quietly or you stop still, they'll sit, as you say, I've had them in the kayak, where they come up and look straight up at you between the paddle and the side of the kayak. And if you just sit still, they'll go down and they'll come back up again and look again. But as soon as you move an eyelid, boom, they're gone. And you've probably seen that when you're fly fishing.
Oh, those golden eyes are just an amazing thing to look into, aren't they?
Yeah, no, it's... But we want to keep you fishermen with seeing them. So it's important. There's lots of other things affect them. I mean, the habitat's been degraded. We're competing with them for water, with water resources, and we're putting lots of things into the streams. But the thing that's really the biggest mortality factor at the moment, sort of instant one, is the yabby traps. And so we've just got to get rid of them. I mean, it's just ridiculous that this is happening. We're allowing this animal that's only found in Australia and is now classified as a near-threatened species to be drowned like Daniel's found, four of them in one trap. It's staggering.
Dr. Tom Grant, thanks for joining us. Let's hope we see reason and follow Victoria, who have been very smart in getting rid of these damn insidious traps, and hopefully we can see sense and do the same. Thanks for joining us on the program.
No problems at all. Thanks for following it up.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
It's The Big Fish, and our Think Like a Fish series went over very well, with Stinker turning into a snapper and a whole host of our favourites on The Big Fish trying to become the fish that they love. And we've got to get Luke Pearce, who's the expert, one of the experts anyway, on the Macquarie perch. He's a very big part of the Macquarie perch recovery program in New South Wales, which is being jointly funded by the angling licences, because our inland anglers really want to bring these fabulous fish back. And we had to get you on to think like a Macquarie perch. Good morning, Luke.
Morning, Scotty.
Yeah, so take us to your home, your habitat. Where do you live?
Yeah, Scotty, I live in cool slopes and upland streams. My range is very restricted now, obviously. Used to be much more widely distributed from basically the upland reaches of most of our southern tributaries of the Murray-Darling Basin, and progressed a fair way downstream, all the way down into the lower reaches of the southern Murray-Darling Basin as well. But now very restricted range in only a couple of spots in the upland sections of the southern Murray-Darling Basin now as well. So, you know, kind of, rocky mountain type streams, you know, sort of places you would expect to find trout as well, or you would think synonymous with trout habitat as well. So lots of rocky cobbly streams and big deep pools and nice vegetation and logs and rocks and all those kind of things.
Do you get on well with your neighbors, your native neighbors, your trout imported neighbors?
We do coexist with trout. Our habitats are similar habitats, and our range our ranges cross over. Then we have similar food requirements, so we obviously eat similar things. So I, as a Macquarie perch, feed mostly on shrimp and small aquatic insects, so insect larvae, things like particularly mayflies and caddisflies and midges, so all the same sort of things that trout eat as well. So obviously we're competing with each other for food and for resources and space within our habitats, but we do coexist and have a bit of a love-hate relationship, I guess.
But you'll live together. What about the dreaded redfin? Are they your friends?
Certainly not, and they're our arch enemy, one of the major causes of our decline across our ranges. So obviously, redfin are one of our main enemies due to the fact that they like to eat our babies, and obviously that doesn't make you any friends. So redfin are a voracious predator and eat our young, and also carry a disease that is lethal to us as well. So we avoid them as much as possible. We avoid them like the plague, because basically they've got a plague that will kill our kind off.
They are the plague. They are the plague. Yeah, it's an interesting fish, and looking at some of the archival footage of when they are in great numbers, what a wonderful fish you are. I mean, clear water, will take a lure, take a fly, take a bait, fantastic to eat, fight like a demon. I mean, you've got everything going for you. You're the glamour boy of the Australian native fish world, aren't you?
Certainly for those slopes and upland regions we were, Scott, yeah, and unfortunately we're not there in the numbers that we used to be. But, yeah, we grow to quite a large size. We'll grow up to about 45 centimetres in length and up to, 3.5 kilos. So we can grow to a really substantial size fish, particularly for those small streams that we're generally found in. And quite an impressive-looking fish, you know, dark black with a quite bright, silvery white eye. Yeah, we're quite a highly visible fish at times in the streams as well. We can be seen cruising around, feeding during the day or early morning and late evening. And historically, we're highly prized from a recreational fishing and also a table aspect as well. Like and regarded as one of the best eating fish from inland New South Wales, if not Australia.
And you have a lot of friends at the moment, a lot of friends amongst the inland angling fraternity who want to see you come back.
We sure do, yeah. We've been getting more and more support and gaining more friendship from our who are originally our foe. You know, obviously anglers were obviously trying to target us and catch us, but now they're supporting us and wanting to bring us back. And we're gaining more and more support from the angling community, but also more widely from other sectors of the community as well. So, you know, the landholders and the farming communities along our streams are trying to improve our habitat and improve the conditions where we live to maintain our populations, and also lots of other people involved in trying to bring our numbers back up to what they used to be and return us into areas where we're no longer currently there.
But the habitat's there, isn't it? Your home's still there. I mean, we look after the upland streams because often the upland streams are our catchments for our irrigation and water supply dams.
Yeah, to a degree, Scott. Like some areas, our habitat's still there. A lot of areas, the habitat's gone, though. And so some aspects of the habitat that are missing from some of our sections are those, those rocky cobble sections that I mentioned before. So that's where we lay our eggs. So we lay our eggs pretty soon, actually. We'll be getting ready to spawn in the next couple of months, and we'll spawn generally early to mid-October when water temperatures reach about 16 degrees. And we'll find areas where there's suitable habitat, which generally consists of large rocky cobble and, you know, fairly shallow sections and a fairly slow sort of gradual flow. So we'll form big spawning aggregations in those areas, and we'll move upstream from upstream and from downstream to these ideal locations and in the empowerment, so in the dams where we exist, we'll swim up out of the dams into the rivers and into these ideal spawning locations and form big spawning aggregations, and that's where we'll lay our eggs. And then those eggs kind of drift down on the current and then settle down in amongst these rocks and cobble. And for those eggs to survive and to hatch, they need really good, clean rocks. And one of the major causes of the decline and the loss of our habitat is a lot of areas, those rocks and that cobble's been smothered by sediment. So sand and soil washing into the streams from the land and from erosion has filled in a lot of those spawning locations that we need, and also filled in some of the bigger, deeper pools that we need to survive the long, hot, dry summers that we get in Australia. So obviously we need deep, cool pools to survive those long, hot summers, and a lot of places they've been filled in with sediment as well.
What's rather strange about you and your relatives is that you're very rare in a lot of our mountain streams and upland streams, but you have city cousins. Do you ever go to Melbourne to visit them?
We don't, but yeah, we've got some cousins that have made the trip down and have moved into the Yarra River in Melbourne. So there's a few translocated populations. So our cousins have also moved over the Great Divide into the Sydney catchment as well. So we've got some populations that have moved over into Cataract Dam from the Murrumbidgee River and a population down in the Yarra River down near Melbourne that have established down there and are doing quite well. Our cousins over the Great Divide and down south in the Yarra are essentially in a lot of instances doing better than the remnant populations of our that are remaining in their natural habitat.
That's very weird, isn't it?
they're
living right in the heart of our second biggest city.
Yeah, that's right. It's amazing. Yeah, it's quite amazing that they're persisting there. And some of those upper reaches of the Yarra are fairly intact and you know, obviously still have good viable habitat to allow us to persist there.
What about the future of your species? Is there a chance for us to see them in good numbers in streams? Is there a chance one day to not have a total ban on their recreational capture?
There sure is, Scott, and I'm confident that, you know, in the future we'll see these fish returned in big numbers and hopefully that will be, you know, improved. The numbers will be improved by, you know, a captive breeding program. So there's a lot of work and a lot of effort going into perfecting the captive breeding program or processes at the moment and potentially be able to produce large numbers of our kind and repopulate some of the areas where we used to persist. And also there's a huge amount of work going into, you know, maintaining and rehabilitating our habitat to improve things so we can, you know, start to expand our existing populations, but also, you know, re-establish populations in areas where we used to be and are no longer able to persist due to the fact that we don't have, you know, the right habitat requirements that we need there. There's exciting times ahead. I think, you know, we've been suffering major declines for a number of years now. You know, John Lake wrote about us declining, you know, back in his day at Naranda, you know. And now we've continued to decline since then and are still declining now. But, you know, with the amount of effort that's going into and improved efforts into the future, you know, I can see a bright future for our kind, and hopefully our numbers will turn around very soon and we'll start to see, you know, us clawing our way back and improving our populations and hopefully one day again being back on the target list for recreational fishers.
And final question, Mr. Macquarie Perch, will you rise to a dry fly?
Absolutely. Yeah, we're a bit silly in that regard, but we take, obviously, one of our main food sources, as I mentioned before, is mayflies and caddis and midges. Generally, we mostly eat the larval stages, but we will eat the emerging and the dry stages as well. So if we're feeding on those, and we will feed on them off the surface. And if you've got a fly that is well tied and well presented, then we will take it with great gusto.
Have everything but the numbers. Good luck with recruitment and good luck with your breeding, Mr. Macquarie Perch. Have a good season.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Scotty.
It's the Big Fish, Luke Pearce, there, becoming a Macquarie Perch in our Think Like a Fish series. A fish expert is warning next summer could see fish kills even worse than the Menindee disaster if we don't get rain. Associate Professor Lee Baumgartner is a freshwater ecologist at CSU Wagga and a member of the Federal Scientific Panel looking at the causes of the fish kills out west earlier this year. He's speaking to Christy Reading and explains that some of our catchments are in even worse shape than they were this time last year.
At the moment, most of the storages in the Murray-Darling Basin are at record lows, and we've had record low inflows, and the majority of the Darling upstream of Menindee now is bone dry, so you can walk up long stretches of the river. We just haven't had the winter rainfall that we needed. We haven't had any big tropical storms come through, which normally fill up the upper parts of the catchment. And so we're starting from a worse situation than we did this time last year. Unless we see some significant rainfall in the next few months, which, if you look at the bomb predictions, it's not looking good.
No.
So there's a real chance that this will happen again this year, maybe even worse than last year and in other rivers.
Is there anything that can be done to prevent or at least minimise fish kills?
You need water. At the fundamental level, you need water because fish need water. But what they're looking at the moment is trying to avoid the situations that happened in the weir pool last year where there was no oxygen, and that really, there's things you can do to mix the weir pool to make sure the water's bubbling. And you want to try and avoid blue-green algae from forming, and you can do that through various ways. You normally do it with water. You'd release water from Lake Menindee or the Menindee Lakes, and that would stop it, and you could flush it out. There's just not enough water to do that. So they're looking at things like water bubblers, aerators, things to move the water around. It's going to be a really challenging year for people who manage water and rivers.
In our part of the world, we have had funding made available for these aerators, at Burrendong in particular, but how much of an impact or how much of a difference can they really make without that water coming into the waterways?
Oh, it's really, really localised.
Mm.
The thinking behind it is even if you create a little refuge zone around the aerators, it's going to be enough to help some fish survive. And when the water returns to normal conditions, those fish are alive and they can breed and recover. It's much better than a complete wipeout where all of the fish don't survive. And that was one of the good things last year. There was lots of farmers and fishermen who were buying these aerators and running them. And there was tons of YouTube clips where you saw fish gathered around these aerators. So they were surviving, and those fish would be alive today because of those aerators. If they weren't there, they would have died. So they do work on a localised scale. And if you think of fish, like a golden perch can produce 300,000 eggs, and a Murray cod can produce up to 100,000 eggs. So those fish can bounce back quite quickly if they survive the tough period.
Do you feel, Lee, that the conversation around this is still continuing, or do you think the media has had some role to play in a focus moving away from these fish kills? How do you think the situation is at the moment?
It's hard. There's a lot of people in the background who are working hard to make sure it doesn't happen again. Media plays a role in raising the profile of the situation. I mean, without that, people wouldn't have known about the situation in India, and it evokes some pretty strong reactions among people. And like as I said, no one wants to see a million fish die. So this year, again, hopefully we can work out what the solutions are to try and stop this from happening, and then we can play a role in promoting those solutions. And I know the New South Wales government right now is going through a process of prioritising all of those and seeing which are the best ones and which ones they'll try and which ones they won't. But in many cases, this is still a big experiment. We haven't seen situations like this.
Associate Professor Lee Baumgartner there, a freshwater ecologist, speaking with Christy Reading.
Here comes Tinker with his fishing tips, some hot advice for your fishing trip. Where to find them? What's the bait? Are you catching any, mate?
Good morning, Stinker.
Hey, g'day, Scott. Great news. I'm still alive.
I was going to use one of your catch cries this morning and say, I'm excited, because I'm excited. I'm excited to hear about your adventures out in the wilds of the Coral Sea with your fishing charter reef trip out way out to Swains Reef, because the listeners last week got the rabbit story again, because we couldn't get you, and we wanted to get all the stories from the week you had at sea with a group of mates. I hope they're still your mates.
They certainly are. I did hear from quite a few listeners that you did play the rabbit story, and one suggested that we call this program The Big Rabbit.
Well, a lot of people around Gilgandra love that yarn, so we got a few requests to give it another spin. And while you're at sea, we couldn't contact you. I hope you've got some good stories out of it. Where do we start?
Oh, probably at the start would be the best spot, I reckon. But I was a bit little hesitant about going on this trip. I've never been, as I mentioned in previously speaking to you, that I've never been really into what you might call charter boat fishing, because I can go fishing pretty much any time I like in Stinkpot. And I know that charter boats do a great job, particularly for people who don't get the opportunities that I get. So anyway, I was talked into coming along. I had been once on a fair dinkum charter out of Coral Bay in Western Australia, and that was a day trip that was about 4 hours or something. And the fishing over there in the Ningaloo Reef was quite crazy. I mean, there were fish jumping all over the place. And then, of course, that ill-fated trip on the Warrener with all the school teachers, which ended up in an all-in brawl.
Yeah, that was a good story.
Yeah, which set education back a long way. But never mind. There were my only, in all my years of fishing, there were my only experiences. So I sort of had some reservations. Plus, Scott, I have heard for years and years how everyone from pretty much every town I ever visited had gone to Swains Reef. And I'm thinking, how on earth can a reef put up with such a population of eager fishers and then be still sustainable? And so I didn't really know what to expect, and that was as simple as that. So we left Nelson Bay with a group, some from Fingal, some from Maitland, quite a few from Maitland, and a couple more from Tweed Heads. And 18 hours later, driving, we pulled into Yeppoon, just out of Rockhampton, to a little place there, Roslyn Bay. And we boarded the mothership, Australiana, and then they said, right, the captain come and spoke to us, a young bloke by the name of Ben, a very, very capable young man. And he was also the cook, Scott. How often is the captain the cook?
Right.
But anyway, he said, righto, he said, now we're going to travel another 14 hours out to sea. But blimey, after travelling 18 hours in the car, we're going to do another 14 hours out to the Never Never. Well, I didn't even know where we were going. Didn't really matter much. But so there were 12 of us on board, 12 in our party, plus a crew of four. And we were armed to the teeth with every possible method of pulling a fish out of the water. Every possible method of pulling spinners and poppers and plastics and droppers and jiggers. And mate, we were going to cause havoc, I can tell you. Anyway, when we got on the mothership, a beautiful boat, it had four tinnies on board about 14 foot long with 20 horsepower motors on them. And the method that when we finally got there the next day and dropped anchor, oh, it was beautiful, absolutely beautiful. This endless, as far as the eye can see, reef which was, you know, only in about under 2 metres of water. I was very shallow. Even you could hit it with a tinny occasionally. And there were no protruding rocks or beaches or anything like that. We were stuck on the mothership and that was that. And so then the clues from the captain was to motor onto the reef and anchor onto the reef. You use as little possible lead as possible, your 50-pound line, we're not there to muck around, and a 9-0 hook, no lead if you can get away with it, and pilchards were bait. They were all supplied, heaps and heaps of pilchards, and you'd burley with the pilchards, and then you'd hook them on your 9-0 hook and toss it in the burley trail, and hang on, hang on. That was the whole lesson. You, when the fish pulls, you pull harder. that was the... Well, and did they pull? It was fantastic. The fishing was absolutely extraordinary. But even on the way there, forgot to mention, we picked up a couple of beautiful Spanish mackerel just trolling out the back of the boat.
Oh, they're great fish, yeah. Great eating fish.
Oh, fantastic. Everything up there is a great eating fish. Even the little ones you toss away. Everything is quality eating fish. Well, the fishing started, and we, the red emperor, red throat emperor, coral trout. Oh, dear me. And actually, there was a commercial coral trout fisherman up there. They catch them live, Scott, for the overseas market.
And keep them alive on the boat.
Yeah, not our boat, but there were the only other boat that I saw in 5 days was a commercial coral trout fisherman.
So when you hear about, you know, so many charters going to Swains Reef, but it's a really extensive complex, is it? There's so much room.
Exactly, and that was what I didn't really quite expect. It is so big that we're not all jammed on the same reef. That was sort of a vision of mine, that we're all going to be 10 boats on the same reef, whacking the daylights out. That didn't happen. Mm. And it's very well controlled by Queensland Fisheries. There are green zones, what they call green zones up there, and you would adhere very, very strictly to the size and bag limits. Like charter boat men, charter boat operators cannot... even crib a little bit because their license depends upon it, Scott.
It sounds very sustainable, Stinker.
Mate, and that was a conclusion that I came to. That was my fear when I arrived, but it was way late. I never, ever considered it again because we would have been one zillionth. We were fished in one zillionth of this massive area, and we caught fish pretty much everywhere you dangled a line. So all those fears of sustainability disappeared, and a lot of confidence in New South, I say, in Queensland Fisheries. So probably the only thing that you don't talk about fish that got away. No one wants to hear anything about your fish that you lost because everyone lost one.
Yeah, particularly in that coral country, which is razor sharp. Yeah,
that's it. But I did, when fishing in a little bit deeper water, my mate. And he just had the pilchard with a little tiny pea sinker and a hooked a thumping great cobia. Well, those things take off like the last bus, you know. I mean, golly, can they go? Well, unfortunately, he lost it at the gaff, and that's the only lost story that I was prepared to mention because everyone else had one. But even a mangrove jack and jobfish, I mean, it was everything, Scott. And then we'd return to the boat and we'd have some lunch and the meals were excellent, absolutely excellent meals cooked by the captain. And then you could sit there in the sun on this beautiful boat and watch the whales. They were all around us, minkies, humpbacks and sharks. Like you wouldn't believe, there's sharks everywhere, all sorts of sharks. Some of them are quite harmless, but they look mean enough. And in amongst them, there was a tiger shark. When he came, everything tightened up a bit. You know, everyone took things a bit more seriously when the tiger shark turned up. But and I had some diving gear.
Did you have a snorkel, Stinker?
Well, Scott, I was keen to have a snorkel, but then I saw the sharks. And I thought, I'm not all that worried about sharks.
No, but when you're up in the shallows, you feel a bit safer, don't you?
Well, yeah, but then... a couple of snakes turned up. Well,
the banded ones?
Oh, mate, I didn't get that close. They could have been banded, blue, purple. I wouldn't know.
But oh, they won't hurt you, stinker. They won't hurt you.
Well, I never knew I could run on the surface, really. But
so you didn't end up having a snorkel?
No, I did not. But not really. The opportunity didn't arrive. No one had a snorkel, and it wasn't particularly for that reason. But it made you certainly think twice. But even at the back of the boat, when you clean the fish and throw the skeletons over the side, the amount of GTs, giant, you know, Trevally. And one bloke actually, Jamie decided he'd hook one. Jamie had a crack at all the big fish, and he hooked one of these GTs. Well, you know what they go like. And then as soon as he got anywhere near the boat, well, the sharks took interest and whooshka, you know. Oh, look, it was a fantastic. And the sleeping arrangements, well, we were sort of under the deck. And it got smellier and smellier as the week progressed. But really, the only answer to that is tough it up.
Yeah, look, at least you all smell, so it doesn't matter, does it?
Well, that's right, all the smells. Yeah,
I mean, it's different if one member of the crew's smelly, but if you're all smelly, well, you're in the same boat, literally.
Well, literally, that's right, yeah. So, and the fish were then cleaned for us and cryovac'd and snap frozen.
Did you eat any of them out there while you were out there?
No. Oh, little bits and pieces, you know, a few wings and things, which were expertly cooked. I mean, everything was perfect. And then, of course, was the trip back to Roslyn Bay and Yeppoon, and then another 18 hours home.
And, Stinker, did you see a lot of live coral? Because we all worry about the bleaching.
It
and
was
the...
all alive. Everything was alive.
That's nice. Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, everything was boiling mass of life. I just sat there and had a cold beer and scanned the horizon. The sunset's glorious. And I'm thinking, this place is just a boiling mass of fish. And really, I experienced something similar at Ningaloo on the other side of the country. So really, when we talk about the north of Australia, it's wilderness country, a lot of it up there. And everyone should go and have a look.
Fantastic.
I would say that this trip has done me the world of good. I've learnt a lot. You know, you fish all your life, but if you don't experience these things, well, you miss out, really. And there are other experiences, of course, that I'd love to, which I'm keen to learn even further in more wilder country. But, yeah, no, it's worth every cent, and I enjoyed it. But what I also enjoyed was the company. We had a tremendous crew. And the people that we took with us, I knew a few, Scott, but I didn't know all of them. And the guys from Maitland and that, they were just great company. So we forged very good friendships that we'll keep for quite a long time.
That sounds like a dream trip. I'm so glad you had a great time. And you got a bit on the Savo too. Don't forget the Salt Festival, the cultural festival celebrating the sea. I believe you're on the bill there.
Well, that's the other side of me. You wouldn't know there's a cultural side there, would you, really?
Oh, look, you're chock-a-block full of... You've got more culture than a tub of yogurt, I reckon.
Yeah, that's about it. Well, we have an opening between 2 and 4 this afternoon, and if anyone's in Port Stephens, I'd welcome them to come down, and we can talk more about my trip if you wish, or come and have a look at what's on display, local artists and local photographers and all the clever people, creators in our area have something on display. My books, of course, that's how I get into all this. And we all just sit there and welcome everybody to Nelson Bay. So it would be really lovely if someone drops in and says, "G'day, Stinker. I heard you on the Big Rabbit," and it'd be lovely to...
on the Big Fish. And where are you doing this, Stinker? Where are you doing it?
Well, it's right on the waterfront in Nelson Bay. If you drive down the main street of Nelson Bay and keep going onto the waterfront, that's where you'll find me.
And it's called the Salt Festival, is that right?
Well, there's a seafood festival in Port Stephens throughout August, and this is part of that. And so we have everything on display at the cultural centre where we have something to do with the sea, whether it be fish or seabirds or whatever else, whales. Everyone's happy about whales around this joint.
At Port Stephens, Nelson Bay. Hey, great to talk to you, Stinker. I'm glad you made it back alive, and thanks for sharing some of the adventure.
Yeah, welcome, Scott. Hooroo.
On ABC Radio, it's The Big Fish with Scott Levi.
Come on down to my boat, baby. Come on down where we can play. Come on down to my boat, baby. Come on down, we'll sail away.
Our last cast this morning is into Darling Harbour, where the boats are bobbing, and Tim Stackpool is on the floor for us down there at the Convention Centre at the International Boat Show. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning to you, Scott. Literally on the floor, spread out on the floor.
Tell us about the setup there for our fisher folk, because it's more than just fishing, isn't there? But there's a fair bit for the fisher people, I believe.
Absolutely. Look, something like 60% of the people that come through the show, and we know this from statistics from the surveys that are done, 60% or so of people that come to the show are people interested in fishing. There are either people who are really devoted, you know, weekend, head out every weekend, or just love doing a bit of fishing with the family. So, of course, the boat show can't ignore that, Scott, and for that reason, there's plenty of stuff for people who love fishing, the anglers. There's guys that sell tackle here, of course, and lots of competition there. If you're looking to freshen up your tackle box or buy some terrific new rods, you can certainly do that as well. I'm just looking around the halls here at the moment, and there's quite a bit going on. Of course, there's two levels of the show, Scott. So even though I'm on the top level at the moment, there's tackle guys on both levels too. And you know, boats that are, you know, built for people who love doing some offshore fishing or some coastal fishing as well. And the trailer guys are here too with some of their new trailers to make it a little bit easier to put your boat in and off the boat ramps as well. So there's loads of stuff. And also those very popular masterclasses, the fishing masterclasses that you love too, Scott. Great lineup, a great schedule of speakers.
Have they got the giant tank full of fish again? That was great.
Yes.
Last year.
Yes, and chock-a-block full of barramundi. Now, you remember how that works. It's like a semi-trailer. It's as long as a semi-trailer, this thing. It has glass sides on it with barramundi. And the guy who's doing the talk sits up like on the cab of the truck where the prime mover would be and casts the line in. And they use the soft lures on the end of the line. And then the barramundi react to that. So you can actually see how different lures and different techniques of fishing can attract those fish. So you can see them when they strike and when they don't strike and all that sort of stuff as well.
And
so
we must mention they take the hooks off the lures.
So yes,
the barramundi,
exactly.
Well, you know, you really see what they like. They'll grab hold of it and hang on to it for a while and then
spit it out afterwards. Yes, it's quite funny to watch. You know, they're not trained barramundi or anything, Scott, but it really is quite remarkable how all that works. And the first time I saw it, it really gave me an insight as to what happens under the water, because a lot of the time we've got no idea how the fish are reacting to our lures. But it's a great demonstration. I think it's worth coming to those fishing masterclasses just to take a look at that. There's three of those sessions daily. You can check on the website at the Boat Show's website to see when they're scheduled. But there's a whole lot of speakers in between.
Yeah, and they're good fish shows. But what it's about, and I think what it's about, Tim, and I know you wet a line occasionally, but you're more of a bushwalker. But these guys are using these lures, soft plastics and other lures. But it's not just the lure that does the work. 99% of the work's the fisher person to impart that action on that lure.
Exactly.
So they can throw a soft plastic in and say, watch this, and they'll wind it as most people would, and the barramundi won't be interested. And then they'll use a technique with either wrist or rod movement or pausing or letting it drop rather than lifting it, so on and so forth. And they'll show you the technique to fish different types of soft plastic, different types of lures. And once they impart that action upon it and show you how to do it, then you realize that you're not fishing your lures to their potential until you do it that way. And and you can see it happening. It's such a visual lesson that you learn on how to work a lure, isn't it?
That's right, Scott. And I think that's the technique that I suffer from. You know, I'm a lazy fisherman. I'll throw the line in with the lure on the end and I'll just expect the fish to come running at it without having to do any work. But learning those little techniques, as you say, the flicking of the wrist, the snapping of the rod, all that sort of stuff is the thing that makes a difference between the great stories at the pub about the one that got away or actually walking home with the fish.
That's right. And the barramundi are the judge. You see that the way they react to the action imparted on the lure. And 1 minute this thing gets pulled through without any action and they're not interested. Give it a little bit of work and they're all of a sudden, their eyes light light up, their fins start to sprout out, and they're keen to go on. What about the boats? Before we get to the boats out the back on Sydney Harbour or Darling Harbour, a big thing this year, electric outboards, and we're not talking about the trolling motors that have been around for a long time. We're talking about something that would replace your outboard in the estuary. There are a lot of companies getting into this now, and I think they're quite fascinating. They're the hot new thing, the environmentally friendly thing for the water. Are there a few of those there?
It's certainly a developing market, Scott, at the moment. And this is the thing. We're seeing a little bit of that, not a whole lot demonstrated on the floor of the show, but plenty of people are talking about it. And we're seeing competition in the motor and the engine market from the combustion engine manufacturers, the traditional manufacturers there, who are making their combustion engine motors leaner and cleaner and far more efficient because of the competition which is coming in, the looming competition regarding more heavy-duty electric motors. And as you say, you know, those trawling motors, the ones that you sit on the bow, have been popular for quite some time. And we're actually seeing a lot of traditional smaller electronic manufacturers getting into that market, those little trawling motors. And some of them do have quite a bit of horsepower behind them these days. But you're exactly right, Scott. This whole business of the electric motors is forcing the competition and the combustion engine competition to think very heavily and clearly about where they want to take their engines. We've seen a few launches of those engines here at the show over the last 2 days. But I think if you're coming looking for those engines at the show, you might find them a little bit sparse on the floor, those electric engines, but there's certainly plenty of people to talk to about that with these engine manufacturers that are at the show to see where that's going to develop over the next, look, just 12 months probably, but certainly the next 2 or 3 years, we're certainly going to see a lot more of that technology that you just talked about.
Yeah, I think particularly for estuary fishing, you know, silent and deadly, and not just the little trolling motors, but actually bigger ones that would replace your petrol engine, far cleaner and greener. We're speaking with Tim Stackpool, who's walking the floor for us at the two levels of the Sydney International Boat Show. There's a big tournament fishing competition on as well with the weigh-ins, the brim, the live brim, who'll be weighed in in the big tank and then let go, none the worse for wear. Tell us about that, because that's become a great feature of the event too, hasn't it?
Yes, happening across the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, that fishing competition. It's a catch-and-release competition, so it starts off in the mornings. And, in fact, you don't need to come into the show to have a look at that. Those guys actually depart and return opposite Harbourside there. There's a big Ferris wheel out the front there at Darling Harbour. That's where you'll see all those boats berth. They'll go out for a few hours. They'll bring their catch back in after the evening on Saturday. And then they have the chance to go out again on Sunday. And, of course, once they catch a heavier fish, they release the one, which is the next lightest, if you know what I mean. You know how the competition works.
Yeah, that's right. And it's overall bag weight and no fish is harmed in the making of the competition. And big
they
money.
Release them as well. Yeah, exactly. So it is. I think it's a $10,000 prize pool. I think that they walk away $10,000 richer at the end of the weekend, the winning team.
And one thing that Darling Harbour is, and I don't know if they can fish up in there, but around the harbour, just chock-a-block full of big brim. I mean, it is one of the great brim fisheries and the best brim fishers, and you can meet them and they'll share their techniques, show you the lures, particularly on the Sunday, I think, Tim, when it's all done and dusted, then they'll let their secrets out.
Yeah, and they're very proud of what they do, these guys, of course. They're the sportsmen, as you know. They've got the sponsorship on their shirts. They wear the liveries all over them, so you can't miss them when they're walking around. They're brightly coloured shirts, these fishing shirts that you've probably seen available in the stores, Scott. So you'll see them around about the show. And as you talked about much earlier in our chat, there's so much to do regarding fishing at the Sydney International Boat Show. I don't think anyone who loves a bit of keen fishing, wherever you are, up or down the coast or a little bit inland if you want to make the trip. The show is open till 7 p.m. every night, Scott, and I understand that if you're just coming for the evening, you can get in after 5 o'clock for just $5. So it's pretty cheap if you're just going to spend a couple of hours and you want to come after 5 p.m.
Yeah, it's a great spot for it, right on the water there, and so many amazing boats to see. It's quite a big industry in Australia, still actually boat building.
Oh, absolutely.
And you'll see a lot of the Australian-made stuff. Anyway, Tim, thanks so much for the guided tour of the Sydney International Boat Show. It's all happening down there at Darling Harbour this morning. What time do the doors open?
10 a.m. until 7 p.m., Scott. So Saturday, Sunday, Monday is the last day.
Come on down, my boat, baby. Come on down where we can.
as the lure of the new boat. We can always dream. And don't forget, if you miss The Big Fish, you can catch it at your leisure on the podcast, on all of those podcast platforms, or through the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.